This is KPTZ Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around town? The guy with the odd sandwich boards across from City Hall. The woman checking people in for the campgrounds at Fort Worden. The kids who wipe down your car at the car wash. This show, Our Town, profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work in Port Townsend. We talk with all sorts of people who make up the eclectic mix in Jefferson County. We talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the northwestern edge of the USA. We'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and teenage beauty queens. We'll find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in Port Townsend. Listening to Our Town is a way to meet some of Port Townsend's authentic and even eclectic people, your neighbors, your friends, and particularly the people you don't know yet, but you'd like to meet them. Today, we're going to talk with two people who have led pretty rough lives. Both were drug addicts and spent years in and out of jail, but these two remarkable individuals have found the strength to turn their lives around. Jody Ruther and Charles Little are both graduates of drug court. That means they're recovering drug addicts. Some people are willing to write off drug addicts. Fortunately, there are others out there who believe that with help, and sometimes a lot of help, lives can be saved, families can be reunited, and former drug addicts can become contributing members of society. Jody and Charles both graduated from the program called Drug Court. If you haven't heard about it yet, the underlying premise is that perhaps sending people to jail for nonviolent crimes resulting from addiction isn't the only way to go. Perhaps the community might be better served if we figure out a way to help people turn their lives around. Drug addiction is a powerful thing, and it isn't easy escaping. Jefferson County Drug Court bands together the judge, the prosecutor, the cops, and the public defender. All these institutions work together to try to give addicts the tools to get their lives back on track. It's a complex thing, but Jody and Charles are two of the success stories of Drug Court. Both now have jobs, homes, and are taking college classes. Let's hear from them how they managed to come so far. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jody, maybe we'll start with you. When did you first get involved with drugs? How old were you?
I started drinking at an early age. I was drinking by the time I was 11, 12, and I was a methamphetamine addict by the time I was 14.
Wow. That goes back a long time.
Many years.
Many years. Charles, did you start that early?
I did. You know, my addiction started quite early. I was about 8, you know, when I realized that, you know, I was becoming relied on these substances. By 14, I was full-fledged addicted to meth, been smoking pot for about 3 years. When I was a little kid, my grandparents and my parents would give us alcohol for toothaches and growing pains and stuff. So addiction's just been in my family for a long time.
And when was the first time you were sort of caught?
So my first charge that was drug-related would have been at 11 years old.
Wow. What about you, Jody?
The first time I had a run-in with the police, I was 10. It was my mom's 50th birthday, and I got an MIP. And my first time with a run-in with narcotics was 1992.
So MIP, minor in possession?
Back then, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because not everyone knows all the terminology.
Yes.
You got to be careful about this. Well, both of you were basically children when this happened. Do the police actually arrest children? What do they do?
I was arrested and released to my mother. They did a deferment of the charges, and I did a whole bunch of community service. And personally, I think that they should have been a little harder on me because I didn't learn my lesson. I was right back at it.
You just continued.
Absolutely.
For me, the very first time I, too, was released to my mom, she owned a restaurant down in Port Hadlock, and they took me there and left me in handcuffs sitting at the area of the restaurant where the employees ate, and she kept asking what I was doing in handcuffs, and the officer told me I couldn't talk if I wanted to not go to jail. Second time I got in trouble, I went to a place called the Proctor House, which back then was not quite as laxed as it is now for some people. And then KYC and juvenile prison, and it just escalated mm-hmm. from there.
And during all of this time, you continued using drugs, I presume.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Didn't stop.
Did you have any motivation to stop?
No, it was a continuous party for me.
Hmm.
You know, at least I thought it was. And, you know, I mean, the further it escalated in my life and the further down the rabbit hole, if you will, that I went, I started to realize that my life wasn't really going anywhere. But even that didn't stop me. You know, I just kept going.
Yeah. From the very first time I was incarcerated at, I think I was 13, was constant in and out and in and out. But I learned that every time I got to go to be detained, either in juvenile, you know, detention or in jail once I turned, you know, adult, that was just my opportunity to catch a break, you know, to catch up on my sleep, to get healthy so that I could, you know, wait for my release date and get out there and do it again. I was glad when they would arrest me, you know, because I could take care of myself and get myself back, you know, to where I could go out and do it again, because that's what my mission was to continue. I had no wish or want to stop.
I used to think that it was cool mm-hmm. that I would go to jail. You know, the other kids I was becoming friends with and the older people that I was becoming friends with, so to speak, even though they weren't really friends, you know, they were all giving me drugs. They thought it was funny and they thought it was cool that I was going to jail. So that I got it, that in my mind that it was awesome, you know, that I was above the law and that I was making all these friends, and it really didn't play out that way, but that's just the way I thought it was back then.
Did both of you continue to live at home?
I did not. I started running away. My dad was always gone because he was an appraiser. And my mom had sent me to go live with my dad, so I was the only one ever home. So he never even noticed that I was gone all the time. So I just stopped coming home, and he never really even knew.
And you were a teenager at that
point. Yeah, I was about 12, 13.
I left my mom's home at 15, 16.
And so did you live on the streets, or did you find a place to crash? How did...
People's couches, parties that I'd been to. I spent a lot of time doing what people call camping. You know, I called it surviving in my addiction. You know, I'd go out and stay high out in the woods and just run around and build trails and tar paper shacks and live in those until they burned down because I didn't have a fireplace.
And yet you refer to it as being partying. Did you really see it that way?
In my mind, it was a freedom. Nobody telling me what to do or how to do it. I could be as chaotic in my mind and in my life and carefree as I wanted. I looked at incarceration as just a bump in the road. At that age, I was so far into my addiction. It was never even a thought in my mind that there was something else besides that. You know, my parents were, you know, alcoholic, and it was just second nature. It was just what you did, you know, and just because the drugs were different, you just... That's what you did.
But surely both of you met, I don't know, teachers or an aunt or a friend who would say to you, hey, look, you're 15 years old and you're doing meth. You should straighten out, and here's why. Didn't some people speak up and try to turn you around?
I tried to avoid those people like the plague.
Yeah.
You know, the reason I refer to it as a continuous party is because people never kick you out of a party when you're supplying the drugs. Huh. You know, so it's always easy to go find a place to crash when you give somebody their fix. They have a place and you need a couch. You go and you hook them up. And then next thing you know, a bunch of people are there. And it does. It turns into one big party. And when you don't stop, it's an endless one. You know, my addiction lasted 15 years strong.
And so what changed? What changed? What caused both of you to view things differently?
I have had long-term sobriety before drug court. I was a single mom and found out I was going to have a second child, and I had been in so much trouble in the town where I was living, and I just tried to get them to let me come home to Jefferson County, and after a lot of fighting, you know, in the courts, they allowed me to come up to my sisters. And that was my first time through Safe Harbor recovery. I was 32, and it was back in 1998.
So you got straight because you were pregnant?
I did, and I stayed sober for a few years. Then I started drinking again and started this, you know, it turns this switch on in your head to where anything goes. And I slowly but surely started deteriorating. I'd go on these drinking binges, and that was in 2004. I started drinking again, and in 2012 is when my life fell apart, or 2010, excuse me, is when my life fell apart. I ended up losing my children, and that was the trigger that set my life in motion. I went straight back to meth. I was hopelessly depressed, just thought the world was going to end. I lost everything. I lost my job. I lost my home, my animals, my cars, everything that I'd ever worked for. And it didn't matter to me because my family was gone. And I just figured that would take it away, you know.
So you mean like the drugs take the pain away? Take the pain away.
Take the pain, take the depression.
And it did or it didn't?
No, but I thought the more that I did, something was going to stop the way I felt inside. And it didn't. It just, my life whirlwind, you know, just, I was hopeless, absolutely hopeless. I didn't care whether I lived or I died, you know.
How quick was the spiral from when you lost the kids?
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
Pretty quick.
Very.
I lost my kids May 10th of 2010, and I stayed sober till about, it was 2 days before my birthday in December, and I couldn't take it anymore. And I went to the first dope house and started using, and I couldn't get enough. You know, it was like, you know, it's explained to you in treatment that, you know, your addiction, no matter how long it is in remission, that they explain the elevator effect. You know, you get off the elevator, and no matter how long you stay sober, your addiction just keeps going down. And when you get back on that elevator, it's like you never stopped. And I became the menace to society and the cruel person that I'd been so many years before in a matter of a week.
Wow.
You know, I didn't care about anybody or anything, including myself.
Very scary.
Mm-hmm.
Very scary. What happened to you, Charles?
To tell you the truth, this woman sitting here next to me is the only reason that I opted into drug court. She's the only reason that I stayed in drug court. I, for lack of better words, I blame her for me being clean. She has been there through and through and through for me. So I got opted into drug court. I took a charge for someone else of a very large amount of methamphetamines. My charges got dumbed down a little bit for my graduation. When I opted into drug court, they dropped some of them.
I think not all of our listeners really understand drug court, how it works. And I'll try to simplistically explain it, and you guys chime in. But basically, if you are up on drug charges, the prosecutor has the ability to offer you the chance to be in drug court.
So now it's any charges that they feel are related to addiction.
Okay.
They kind of steer away from violent crimes or anything that's got anything to do with possession of a firearm. But they've even been known to take people for that. It used to just solely be for possession. but it's not anymore. They've kind of broadened their horizon. They take the high-risk offenders now, people like me and Jody.
Explain what a high-risk offender is.
A high-risk offender is anyone who is a menace to society that they feel doesn't really have a chance at anything other than time in prison if they continue down the road that they're headed down or has already been to prison.
Or a high-risk offender is somebody who they feel is going to keep reoffending. I was one of the first high-risk offenders. I was the first high-risk offender let into drug court.
You had been incarcerated several times, right?
Many, many times, starting out at 14 years old, you know.
Okay.
But my criminal record showed that I could go little bouts of time with no police interaction, and then it was bang, arrest charge after arrest charge, you know, and then I would, you know, straighten up for a little while and then it would happen again, you know, and it was a revolving door.
Okay. Well, you know, I find that the name drug court, when I first heard about it, I thought it was like a court, but it isn't a court, really. I mean, explain how the program actually works, what actually happens.
It's kind of like a group therapy at a table. The judge sits in, the deputy prosecutor, you know, sheriff sits in from time to time.
Ford Kessler
from Safe Harbor. You know, and it's a focus group is really what it is. Yes, they will throw you in jail for messing up. Yes, they will give you community service for not doing things that you're supposed to be doing. But really, the main focus is on the people that are sitting there and the people that are sitting across from you and talking about what's been going on in your week and struggles that you're having and things that you're working on. And then, like when I was in it, people would chime in. The table was quite strong when I first got in there, and shortly thereafter, you know, people would speak up and say something to other people. It's kind of laxed in that a little bit lately, but I believe that it'll get there again. You know, there are some members at the table that are, I feel that they're strong in their recovery right now. And if they bring that back to the table, you know, it's gonna work out for it, just like it was when I was in there.
Drug court is very intense when you first begin. And as you go through the, you know, when you first start, when I first got into drug court, I didn't know whether I was coming or going or already been there. My head was in a whirlwind. I was fighting for custody of my kids back. I had all these charges on me. I was looking at, a stint in prison. And my attorney and I applied for drug court, and they kept turning me down. And when you first get in there, you are required to do either inpatient or intensive outpatient, and you're required to do at the minimum 5 self-help meetings a week, and you go to group 3 times a week, and you call in every day, Monday through Thursday, you know, between 8:30 and 9:30, you know, to see if you're on a random UA list, and you do that at least twice a week. And the bottom line is you have choices. You know, you go back to school or you get a job. You have to have a high school diploma or a GED to graduate. And slowly, you have to be so broken that you are willing to be told what to do. When I first got there, it was a game to me. I'm a very strong-willed, manipulative person in my addiction, and my plan was to just get through it.
Okay, well, I think you outlined some of the things that our listeners really can't get their head around just yet. The drug court itself, there is a weekly sort of group therapy thing, if we want to call it that, around the table. But when you start, you also, I think you just said you have to go to 5 meetings a week.
Mm-hmm.
What was the 3?
There are 3 outpatient groups.
Right.
They're 3 hours long.
And you have to have random urine analysis.
Yes.
You have to call in every day.
Yes.
You have to fulfill before you, so they use the term graduate from drug court, but you, in order to complete it, you just said you have to finish your GED or high school. You have to
either be employed or be going to school full time. Mm-hmm. Half-time doesn't count. If you're doing it half-time, you have to be employed also, mm-hmm. you know. And those are requirements that you have to meet.
Yeah. It is nothing. Looking back at it, it was the things that we needed to be taught. We didn't fit anywhere, you know, because of the choices we had made in our lives.
Right. If you were, you know, out living in the woods since you were 14 or something, mm-hmm. you don't really fit real well with any group.
It was impossible for me to coexist with anyone that wasn't in active addiction when I first got there. And I fought drug court tooth and nail for a long time.
How?
Yeah. I was forging meeting slips. I was just, you know, not wanting to do the stuff that they were asking me to do in group. I didn't want to do the paperwork. I didn't want to write stuff down. I didn't really want to hear what they had to say. You know, and I was just kind of going through the motions like, I'm staying clean. What more do you want from me? Mm-hmm. But once I relapsed and I realized that that wasn't working for me, I started going to meetings instead of forging slips. I managed to stay clean for 7.5 months, and then I relapsed again, and I had a heart attack. That was my moment of clarity.
Now, how old were you when you had this heart attack?
26.
Okay. That's pretty unusual for a 26-year-old to have a heart attack if they were clean.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know?
That was my moment of clarity. I've been clean ever since. They sent me to a long-term behavior mod. At that moment, I conformed. I did what I was told. I did what I was asked. I did more than I was asked. I didn't have another choice. At that moment, I realized that all the people I'd ever thought were my friends were not my friends. A lot of them left me where I had my heart attack at to die. And if it wasn't for someone who was in active addiction that happened to know my older brother, they probably would have left me there, but that person put me in her car and brought me home. And that next morning I called Jody and she took me to turn myself into drug court. I went to jail. They held me in jail for 7 days and then sent me to a long-term behavior mod. And my life has never been the same since.
Well, I think you just touched on something very important, Charles. I think that a lot of people, you're given the choice if they want to offer you drug court to either you're going to jail or you're going to drug court. A lot of people would pick drug court because it sounds easier.
It is not the easy way out. It is not.
Laying in a jail cell, getting, you know, my meals served to me and watching TV all day is a lot easier. It is a program for people who really want to change their lives.
Well, it sounds like at least Charles, when he first was in, didn't really want to change it.
Yeah,
he
struggled. So this is what my lawyer told me when I opted into drug court. He says, look, you don't have to do this. But even if you choose to opt out in 2 weeks, you'll be out of jail. He said, and I know that's what you want. You don't want to sit in jail any longer than you have to. If you opt into drug court, they'll let you out and you can go to safe harbor and do your eval. And if you choose that you want to opt out of drug court, you can opt out and you'll probably stay out of jail until your next court date, if that's what you want to do. But at least give it a shot. Give it 2 weeks. I gave it 2 weeks and I cried every day at the table for 2 weeks. Every group I went to, I cried. Every meeting I went to, I cried. And so I stopped going to meetings. I didn't want to feel like that.
Well, but I'm sure you weren't the only person that would cry at some of these meetings.
I still cry.
I'm literally crying right now.
Yeah. So, okay. No, it's okay. Our listeners can't see you, but I can. Yeah.
Just because people have bumps in the roads when they come to drug court doesn't mean that they don't inside want to be free. When you come to and you start having all these emotions and you feel and you know the things that you've done to people and, you know, in your past, and you have to face that. Some people struggle really bad, and the only thing we've known all our life is to get loaded to where we don't have to feel it.
So use a real example.
When I lost my kids, mm-hmm. Even though I had had, sobriety before and I had had a program of recovery before, when I lost my kids, the only thing that triggered in my mind was to get loaded. I wouldn't feel it anymore if I was loaded. But there comes a time with no matter how loaded you are, you still feel it.
Yeah.
And when you come out of it, when you start sobering up and feeling those emotions again, unless you are totally 100% ready to depend on the person next to you, to get you through that day, you are going to struggle. You are going to revert back to the one thing that you know, and that is to get loaded. And when Charles struggled, that is what he would do. He would get to that point where he's got so much emotion running through him and having to deal with, the things you've done to people and the person that you were, you slip up, And Charles struggled for a while until they sent him to long-term inpatient treatment. And from there, the person that's sitting next to me today is not the person that I met out there. I always knew Charles had a heart, and I always knew that there was something in this world better for Charles, and I could not for the life of me figure out his story and why he was, so addicted.
So you two knew each other for a long time. You knew each other when you were both using?
Absolutely.
When Jody actually got busted, the whole reason that she was in drug court, she called me because when nobody else in this town could get any drugs, I could. Because nobody around here, I was such a menace and, just a piece of work that people didn't like having me around. Things would go missing from people. And even if I didn't take it, I'd get the blame. And that was normally the case. Somebody would take something just because I happened to be around, and then I'd get blamed for it because I happened to be around when that other person took it, and that was the case all the time. I was everybody's scapegoat. So I always got my stuff from other places. I didn't get it from around here if I could help it. So she asked me to hide her while she sobered up so that she wouldn't lose her kids again. And I did. I took her out into the middle of nowhere, out in Blue Mountain Road, Port Angeles, and I left her.
Really?
Yep. At a friend of mine's house. Okay. And I left her there to get clean. She called me, a couple days later and told me she was ready to turn herself in, and came and got her and took her. She turned herself in. She went into drug court. And then a little over a year later, I got myself busted. And, because she was in drug court and she was doing so good, I thought that it was the perfect opportunity for me to maybe give it a shot. I'd never, ever tried to be clean before in my life. I've always tried to change my surroundings, moving from here, moving from there, I wasn't trying to get clean. I was just trying to avoid problems
in
my life.
Now it sounds like Jody tried to get clean a few times on your own.
When I went back out and, I found out that there was a warrant for my arrest, we go back to where I told you that I knew Charles had a heart, and he was the only one I could think of, and I called him and I said, "Charles," I said, "I'm probably going to go to prison for a really long time." I said, "But I don't want my kids to know that I'm, loaded," because they were living with my sister at the time. And he says, "Okay, I'll come get you." And I knew that the chances of me not going to prison were huge. I was probably going to get a while at least. And I sobered up and I turned myself in March. And my attorney...
Of what year? What year are we talking about?
Oh, 2011.
Okay.
And it took my attorney until June 8th, 2011 was my first drug court.
Okay.
It took my attorney that long to... get the prosecutors convinced, and Scott Rosecrans was the one that decided to take a chance on me. He had, you know, learned about high-risk offenders.
Right. He told me that.
And I got to be their little guinea pig, I guess you could call it. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like, you know, when you each started drug court, your motivations were slightly different at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like Jody was more determined to succeed. It sounds like when you first went there, Charles, you...
I was just trying to get a charge off my record. My grandmaster plan was stay clean for a year. You know, I could use a little bit of sober time, thicken back up, because I was really, really skinny. My intention was not to stay clean for the rest of my life.
Mine wasn't either.
You know, and I still may not. You know, that's yet to be seen. But I know that I'm sober today. And I've been sober since I graduated drug court. And since my last relapse, I've really, really, really been trying to do this. You know, I've deleted everybody from my social media that uses, and that includes family. I actually had to delete my own brother when he relapsed. And I had to tell Jody that she had to tell him that I wanted nothing to do with him, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was actually the reason I went out and relapsed last time. You know, I'd been holding some pretty huge resentments towards my family, him, a very large one. I'm not really going to get too far into that. So I was living at an Oxford house. He was getting released from prison and they voted to move him into my Oxford house. I felt like it wasn't a safe place for me to stay anymore. And that night I went out and I ate 3.5 grams of meth. I had a heart attack.
Incredible.
When I went into drug court, I was done. But I had no intentions of conforming the rest of my life to what they wanted me to do. I would be under their supervision and their rules for the next year. And I could do that. But then whatever happened after that was my choice, is what I went into it with. Not necessarily that I was going to, you know, go back to meth, but nobody was going to tell me that I could never drink again, that I could never, you know. It's just that manipulator in you, you know.
Okay, now, drug court, actually, it's not a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am kind of thing. It takes, what, a year or 2 years to get through the program?
I have seen people.
Okay, you tell me.
She graduated and nothing flat. Me, it took about 3 years.
Okay.
You know, they tell you, if you talk to somebody in recovery, they'll tell you of that moment that changed their lives. As weird as this may sound to some people, my life-changing moment happened at that drug court table.
What? What happened?
It was my turn to talk.
Right.
And for once in my life, I was sitting at the table and I was telling of my struggles that I was dealing with. And I was talking about going to court and still not being able to have visitation of my kids and how hard that was for me. And I was so tired of it happening, but I did it sober. I took it and I dealt with it. I turned to my support network. I picked up on my meetings. I worked with a sponsor. I didn't want to get loaded again. And I was sitting there at the table that day and I was just crying. And I was, you know, letting this all out at the table because it's like I said before, that table becomes your family. When you come into drug court, you are stripped of everybody that you thought was your friends, everybody that you have depended on for years, even though it wasn't really depending on somebody. It was just your next person to get high with. Everyone you think is your friends and that love you and care for you. You're not allowed to hang out with drug users or known drug users or people that are not, you know, in recovery. So I learned that table was my support. And my turning point was when Scott turned to me and said, you know, Jody, he goes, week after week, you come in here and you amaze me. Take what is coming towards you and you deal with it and you don't let it stop you. Absolutely amaze me. And I looked at him and I thought about it and I left drug court that day just thinking in my head, how can somebody like the prosecutor think that me as who I am could amaze them? And that was my turning point. For the first time, I wasn't thrown in jail by a prosecutor or screaming at a prosecutor or being hauled out in handcuffs because I was fighting with the prosecutor. If somebody in that position could think that I was worth something, that changed me that day. And it made me realize that I am human and I can change who I am. And people are going to love me and care about me. And from that day on, it has been all about my recovery and my family and, you know, the new friends that I have and the things that I've done to help others in recovery. You know?
You're listening to KPTZ FM 91.9, Port Townsend. This is Mary Ann McNellis. The show's called Our Town. I'm talking today with two amazing people, Jody Ruther and Charles Little, who have both graduated from drug court here in Jefferson County. They're talking about their struggles with addiction and their recovery and what drug court has meant to them and is meaning to other people right now. Now, I did go to one session of drug court and a lot of different people there around the table, and I have no way of judging, but roughly, what do you guys think? What's the odds that people succeed there? I mean, is it?
You know, it's really hard to say. So personally, I have watched people come in that I thought were going to fail. And I now know that that's wrong of me to judge people that way. But I was still pretty early into drug court when I saw that. And I figured that they were destined to fail. And some of them have proved me wrong. Some of them completed. Some of them have gone and relapsed after completing. It's really hard to really put an exact number of people that it helps or a percentage even. But I do know this. It teaches tools. If you stick it out, whether you relapse or not, or when you complete, you go back to what you knew before, you've learned tools that you'll never forget.
Okay, so what are some of the tools?
The number one rule they teach you in recovery is to reach out, you know, to get yourself a support network, people that you can call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they're going to answer their phone and they're going to be there for you. You know, I graduated drug court in 2012, but I'm still strongly connected to it. And I have watched people succeed. I have watched people fail. And I have watched those succeed and fall. And what I've noticed is that if they complete drug court, whether they get out and they fall down, and by fall down, I mean relapse.
They always keep coming back.
They come back and they know how to call us. I get phone calls a lot from them and they say, I've fallen again. And it's like, you know what to do. You know the tools and you know the rules. And the number one rule you broke was thinking those people were your friends again. And we help each other. We depend on each other.
I call her and ask her for help all the time.
Charles tried to leave Cedernar one time.
Twice,
you know?
Actually.
And he called me up and he goes, come get me.
She asked me to put the counselor on the phone. Told the counselor that if they let me leave, she was going to be severely upset. And then I put the counselor on the phone and she's like, is it too late? They're like, no, it's not too late until he walks out the door. And even then he can always come back. And so she ended up talking to him for another couple of minutes and they sent me to my room.
No, actually, they put him back on the phone with me, and Charles had been on crutches because he hurt himself during a softball game. And I said, well, I talked to your counselor, and this is how it is. I said, I love you with all my heart and soul, but it's going to be a long hobble to that ferry because I ain't coming to get you. And you do that. You learn to be, you know, that support and that voice that you don't want to hear.
She's given me a lot of tough love. But at the same time, you know, her heart has always been in the right place for me. I would not be where I'm at in my life today if it wasn't for Jody saying things that she has said to me that I just thought, man, what a, you know, and I love her, you know, she's been my rock for a long time.
You know, one of the other tools that we learn is holding each other accountable.
Yeah.
You know, for our actions and our attitudes. And we come out of this in infancy. We don't know how to hold a conversation. We don't know how to act in public. We don't. And, you know, some people are worse than others. And the people who call you out and tell you, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. That is an old behavior, or, you know, that is something we do when we're in using mode, you know.
Use an example.
Go ahead, use me.
Exactly. Charles had a really hard time and sometimes still struggles with having contact with the wrong people. And I have not a problem, as soon as I hear about it, calling him and letting him know, what were you doing with so-and-so, you know?
You know, and it's not always that they may be clean and still be the wrong people.
Absolutely.
You know, they may not be clean and I just don't know it. And they're just telling me that they are. And it's happened a few times. People yep. that are, because I don't live here anymore. And now I live over in Shoreline. You know, I'm a City of Seattle employee. So when I come back here and I run into people or I say hi to people that I thought were clean, sometimes they're not, you know, and I don't know because I've deleted a lot of people from my social media. And just because I hear that they're clean or something, I don't really know.
And, but
and it's really hard for me to not stop and say hi to someone that I know. Usually I can tell if they're in an active addiction. Sometimes I can't.
Yeah.
And when Jody finds out about it, she chews me a new one. She has kept me under her wing in her recovery until I've been strong enough to stand on my own two feet. I was not capable of making decisions for myself for a very long time. And even now, I still ask for permission to do certain stuff. Mm-hmm. I call her and I say, hey, you know, I got this going on. She'll be like, well, you know, you got your support and everything. Yeah, okay, well, then you should be fine. And if anything happens, let me know.
Well, now,
really big tools that you learn in drug court is, number one, you stay clean the whole time that you're in there and you complete. If you go back out, you know that you can stay clean again. It's harder to come back. It always is. It's always harder to come back after a relapse. But you always know that you accumulated quite a bit of clean time, and you can do that again.
Mm-hmm.
When stuff gets really rough, just remember, you stayed clean for however long, and life was all right. You know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, roses or nothing, but my life is good. I've never had it so good.
You know, when you sit around that table in drug court, you know, you watch people deal with death. You watch them deal with breakup. You watch them deal with everything that can be tossed at you in life. You watch the people at that drug court table struggle with and stay sober and stay clean. And one of the things that I took away from that table is knowing that I never have to use again. You know, I watched people lose their grandparents and people lose their parents. I watched people, you know, lose their children, you know, and fight and gain back visitation. I've seen every scenario and I've watched these people go through it sober. So in watching them, I knew that I could too if I ever had to deal with those, because I watched other people around that table learn from it and deal with it sober. So there's not a situation that I have to allow to take me back out there.
So how is your life different now?
It's probably the words that everybody's going to expect me to say, but I can't help it. My life is amazing. They have you write out these assignments when you're in groups. And one of the assignments is, what are your one-year goals and what are your five-year goals? And if you give yourself the opportunity to take in everything that you can learn and everything that, you know, sobriety has to offer, you realize that by the time, you know, you're 1 to 2 years sober, you've accomplished everything on that five-year goal list. I have a full-time job. I have my children in my life. My 16-year-old lives with me. My 22-year-old is around all the time. I have a meaningful relationship. I'm in school.
You tell me you have a 3.9 GPA?
Yes, and I actually just finished this quarter with a 90.7 in English and a 94.1 in sociology, you know. If I had known as a teenager that I could get grades like that, Lord knows where I'd be. But you know what? I get that opportunity.
What's your goal with the educational stuff? Where do you want to be?
I have not quite figured that out yet. But one of the things that I've learned is there's nothing that I can't do. That if I put my heart and soul into it and I put my mind to it, I can achieve it.
What about you, Charles?
God, how has my life changed?
Yeah.
So the common term when you're no longer using drugs or alcohol is recovery. You know, the definition for recovery is to regain something that you lost. I have something that I've never lost, and that's because I never had it. I've been reborn, if you will. My life is completely different. You know, when I first started getting clean and I really started trying to do this, you know, and not just kind of go through the motions in drug court. And, you know, I really realized that I needed to change. I was okay with the fact that I could stay clean and I'd probably not be happy. And I was okay with that. My goal was to stay clean, and I knew that I wasn't going to be happy. Now I know that I can be happy. You know, I have a great job. I work with great people. Most of them are also in recovery, or they're not addicts at all. I work for a program out of Seattle Parks and Rec. I live with a great group of guys. I have a house that I live in. Instead of a tar paper shack out in the woods or somebody's couch that doesn't even really want me there, but they're letting me stay there because I'm giving them drugs. I have clean and sober friends that will do anything to help me in my recovery, stay clean and sober. I have people reach out to me. They ask me for advice. People That's didn't true. Even want to listen to me when I couldn't hold a sentence together because I was too high. You know, I never thought in my life that I would be where I am today, physically, mentally, and emotionally. And that's another thing. I've always had a big heart, but I've always really tried to mask my emotions, tried to play the tough, you know, guy exterior. And today I freely let my emotions show. I walk into my office every morning where I work. And I have a genuine smile on my face every day when I wake up and every day when I go in there. Sometimes I get asked if I'm high, you know, that's not what it is. I wake up every morning blessed because nothing has gone wrong for me yet and nothing's gonna unless I let it.
Okay.
And even then, I can always cheer myself up. And I've never, ever felt that before in my life.
Okay. I hate to tell you this, but we're just about out of time. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ FM 91.9. I've been talking with two remarkable, strong people, Charles Little and Jody Ruther, who are both graduates of drug court here in Jefferson County. This is a program that is helping addicts turn their lives around, and I'm sure listening to this show, you can hear in their voices and their stories all that they've been through and how much the drug court program has helped them and is helping others. Thank you so much for being here. And stay tuned to KPTZ for more dynamite local programming.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by Sonny Flores.